Hi, I'm Eric Jorgensen from the Maine Humanities Council, and I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine.
I'd like to welcome Mary Rice LaFosse from Bates College, who is going to tell us about the phenomenon of the crime passionnel, particularly in light of Stendhal's story. So please join me in welcoming her this morning.
Thank you. It's tough to follow such erudite and witty speakers, especially since they seem to have delivered half of my paper already. But I hope you don't mind if it's a bit redundant. I think that I'm recapping on some of the themes that they have touched upon, and I'll get to the crime passionnel as well. Mary Ellen Burkett asked if the red and the black is taught in Maine. And I'm happy to say that it certainly is. But I should explain that after you've all gone through this work, it's a tough thing to do to assign this book in French to people for whom French is a second language. So we tend to assign it as excerpts. And what I teach in my 19th century French class, which is a very similar novel, is by Balzac, Le Père Goriot, Old Goriot. And it has a similar dilemma. The main character, Eugène de Rastignac, is a young nobleman from the provinces. Okay, so he has the family name, but it's not good enough because he's from the south somewhere. And he arrives in Paris, and he has to make his way in much the same way that Julien Sorel is trying to arrive in society, to climb socially. The difference between the two novels is that Eugène de Rastignac has to compromise. And so to take the ending of Mary Ellen Burkett's talk, where Julien in the end retains his integrity. And Eugène de Rastignac does not. And so oftentimes the students, who are very idealistic, very much want to see an example of someone who does not betray himself in some way. He remains true to himself. And so students are not assigned the book, but they end up doing theses on it because they're so intrigued by the notion of the contrast between the two heroes. So I did want you to know that we do read The Red and the Black. And speaking of which, why does it appeal to my students? Well, in the last talk we heard about the possibility of a meritocracy. And if you think about students at small liberal arts colleges in New England, they really and truly want to believe in meritocracy. They know that they are bright and intelligent and idealistic, and that they are going to succeed in a world that may be corrupt and difficult for them. And so I think that the appeal of the novel, which was the appeal of the novel for me as an undergraduate, is that idealism. Is that sense that, yes, I can, I'm bright and I'm willing and I'm energetic and I will be true to myself and make it. And I think that is the appeal even today. It's a young person's novel in some ways. And in fact, it was the first chapter of my undergraduate thesis. And so this particular day has given me the opportunity to come back, and I see it in a very different light. I should tell you a little tiny bit about my own trajectory. I went on to graduate school. In fact, I had to name three works that were most influential on me as an undergraduate, and I chose Shakespeare's The Tempest, Pascal's Pensée, and The Red and the Black, and I can't tell you why. But it got me into Yale. Anyway. It's been a long time. Actually, another reason that I don't teach The Red and the Black is because of the length and the difficulty in the reading because it's long, but also because these days we've made room in courses in French literature for women writers like George Sand. And so if you're going to read the great women writers, then you have to cut some of the great men. And again, we sort of seduce them into doing The Red and the Black for their thesis. sometimes in contrast to a woman as well. So I have gone from being a narratologist of men's writing to being a scholar of women's writing as well, and you'll hear more about some of the women writers I work on in a bit. But as a feminist scholar, okay, Simone de Beauvoir aside, how does a feminist scholar approach a novel in which, at the climax, the hero shoots the woman he loves? And I think we heard that question over and over again. But I think that we have to remember that it is a novel. That we know she's not really dead in the end. You know? And that's a part of the romantic code. And I'd like to talk about that romantic code a bit before I get into because it fits into the crime passionnel. So The Red and the Black, it's an exceptional piece of fiction, and we readers participate in the codes through which it makes its meaning, but we have to understand them in order to do that. So let's turn to the text. There are lots of indications in the text that Julien Sorel is a quintessential romantic hero, and we've heard about that. He's bright, he's energetic, he's hypersensitive, and he's capable of great passion and ambition. He's also very fragile physically. His brothers are these two big giant guys who work at the mill, and Julien is fragile. And someone mentioned that masculinity is a part of the Napoleonic value system. But I don't have an image, but there are images of the young Napoleon crossing the Pont d'Arcole, and he's got wind going through his hair. And he's very feminine in those images, and I think of Julien in that way. But the chief characteristic is this ability to feel deeply. He's romantic because he can feel deeply. And we see this in his first encounter with Madame de Renal, where he's got the tears on his face. And then when he shows up, when he finally makes it into her bedroom, he thinks he's going to be the conquering hero, Napoleon, and all of this, and he throws herself throws himself at her feet and bursts into tears. And that's what wins her over. It's the passion. It's the ability to feel deeply. Madame de Renal is his counterpart. She, and this is a quote from page 21, she had a certain air of naturalness. Naturalness is very important to the romantics, the ability to be true to oneself in your inner soul. So she had a certain air of naturalness and youth in her walk. To Parisian eyes, this unaffected grace, full of innocent vivacity, could even go so far as to suggest a mild sensuality. But if Madame de Renal had been conscious of a success of that kind, she would have been deeply ashamed. Her heart was a stranger to coquetry and affectation. So there's this very sincere, passionate woman. And who is she married to? A dud. I mean, he's very successful. He's a noble. It was probably a marriage that her parents thought was wonderful. And it says something to us about marriage in 19th century France. There's a strong critique of marriage in this novel. For Monsieur de Renal, Madame de Renal is Madame de Renal most of the time. He refers to her once by her name when he thinks he's going to lose her. Her name's Louise. I don't know if you even knew that. Which is interesting, it's a name from the nobility. But her role as a wife is to fulfill a social and economic function. And when he thinks that he is going to lose her because of the scandal, he receives anonymous letters and so on, his concerns are, what are the neighbors going to think of me? I'm a cuckold. And I'm going to lose her inheritance. The aunt in Besançon is going to let her come and live with her, and there goes the money. He doesn't really, that's their relationship. Renal sees his wife as a mirror of his own identity, and when he thinks about losing her, these are the things that come up. And she, on the other hand, when he thinks about losing her, he thinks, you know, it would be really bad to lose her because she really, really understands me. And it's true. She knows exactly how to manipulate him. And she does become manipulative when she's having Julien paste together another anonymous letter to look like there are all kinds of conspiracies and that he's just become a victim of jealous people in the town, which he'd really like to believe. She understands him. And he makes the point a couple times that he can't understand women at all. These machines, they're weird. And he uses the word in French, machine. It doesn't really mean machine as in a robot or something like that. It's more, he doesn't understand the makeup of women, the physical makeup of women. But it's not a nice word anyway. So that's the situation in which Madame de Rênal commits adultery with Julien. She has never been loved passionately before Julien. She produces the three children, which, you know, that's her social role. She does all the things that she's supposed to do, but she's certainly not fulfilled as a woman, and that sort of puts a different spin on things. And that's very much in the code of romantic literature, where love and marriage are separate things. They're not in the same realm. Another indication of Julien's superiority is that he's associated with heights. I know that the setting is very humble when we first see him, but he's in the rafters of the sawmill. He has to come down to Monsieur de Rênal's level. The person who's high, the person who's superior, is Julien. You know, the sawmill is still a proletarian kind of a setting, a worker's setting, but even so. And you'll find that there is one wonderful moment where he goes off. He has to take leave for a while till things calm down, and he goes to visit his friend Fouquet. But on the way to visit Fouquet, he stops in a natural setting, and he's up in the mountains, and there's a bird of prey, probably an eagle, because the eagle was the Napoleonic symbol. And he finds complete peace in that particular setting. And he, you know, there are many romantic heroes that do this. Chateaubriand's René goes up, and I think it's Vesuvius, but he's on a volcano, and he's looking into the volcano, and of course the lava, the seething lava, reminds him of his own passions, and he's up above everybody. The world is down below. They're inferior, they're mediocre, and concerned with very petty things, and he is grand. And Julien is very much in that mold. There's a poem by Lamartine where he's on a mountain, and it's the same sort of thing. The pastoral setting is nice, but he's the one that's superior. So that's the difference, though, between Chateaubriand's René and Julien, is that it's 1830, and Stendhal can't leave Julien sitting on a mountain. It's not relevant. And I would argue that the politics in this novel are very apparent, even though they're hidden. And I'll get to that a little bit more. And Julien has to become a social climber in some ways. The critic Jefferson Humphreys has suggested that what makes the Red and the Black such a compelling fiction is that its reversals and its ironies are the same as those encountered in real life. And this is considered a romantic novel, but also a realist novel. Julien is, in fact, very good at climbing. Did you notice how many ladders there are? I'm not going to go into the Freudian symbolism that could possibly arise. Freud has an essay that has ladders in it, I believe. I don't know, or some Freudian one. It's an important motif. And in fact, Julien reflects on this motif in his story. On page 352, he's got the ladder. He's got it in place in the garden, and he's going to go visit Matilda a bit later. And he says, "This is an instrument," he said to himself, laughing, "that I am fated to employ." So this isn't the first ladder he has seen. But he's better at going up, again, the height. He's better at climbing, going up, than coming down. When he has to leave the bedroom, right, he can't climb down. He has to slide. And when he gets to the end, he finds that he's all bloody. And in fact, I think this is a foreshadowing of his fall at the very end of the novel. So the ladder is funny, and the ladder is a melodramatic motif, but at the same time, it has a lot of meaning. And here's where I get to the pistols. My title, okay, evokes the famous authorial aside on politics in the novel, okay, and that's on page 394. Stendhal, ostensibly the author and the editor are talking, and he says, politics, and we've had some nice concert music as well, politics is like a pistol shot in a concert. And the notion is it doesn't really belong there, but the editor says, it's 1830. If you don't talk politics, you don't have a novel about 1830. So again, I think that politics and the pistol shot is there, and it's there really, and it's there in metaphor as well. There are lots of pistols. Again, another melodramatic motif, but as we've seen, people have access to guns. In the Delacroix painting that we just saw, it's a little apprentice that has two pistols. It was a fact of life in 19th century France. But it's not Julien who is the first one to think about these kinds of things. It's actually Monsieur de Renal. He at one point anticipates that he has to have a duel with Monsieur Valnon because things are getting, their antagonism is escalating. And he buys pistols and he has them loaded. Julien is actually afraid of the possibility of getting shot every time he goes up ladders. And so that's, if you look, he thinks about pistols. And by the time he goes to Mathilde's room on the up the ladder, he has pistols in his pocket. The most crucial pistol shot is, of course, the one that Julien fires at Madame de Renal and brings Julien's novel. And he doesn't say romance in the original French. He says novel, roman. He's reflecting on this in the same way that Stendhal reflects on the fact that Mathilde is a character, because nobody could be like this in real Parisian society, and I don't think he believed that at all. Julien's attempt on Madame de Renal's life is precipitated by the letter penned by his first mistress because her confessor had demanded that she do it when Monsieur de la Mole had asked for an acknowledgement of his fictional parentage. And it's interesting, that comes out about as a because of the duel that he has in Paris, where he's slightly wounded, and the nobleman with whom he has dueled turns to his friend and he says, I can't possibly admit to having had a duel with this plebeian. I have to, we've got to spread the rumor that he's the illegitimate son of a noble. And that's actually how Julien Sorel de la Vernay comes about. Monsieur de la Mole just keeps embroidering on that. And the letter, and we've heard about this letter before, what she says in it at the behest of her confessor is, penurious and rapacious, this man sought to achieve a position for himself and become something in life by means of the most consummate hypocrisy and by the seduction of a weak and unhappy female. What you might not have noticed is that Julien sees this, and on page 352 of the novel, if you have it on you, this is exactly where he's decided that the ladder is his instrument of preference. If I had been killed in Monsieur de Renal's garden, there would have been no dishonor in it at all for me. They could easily have made my death a mystery. Hear what terrible tales they will come to tell in the salon of the Hotel de Champs, the Hotel de Caylus, the Hotel de Retz, etc. Everywhere eventually for posterity, I will be a monster. For two or three years anyway, he added gaily, laughing at himself. Again, he's ready to go upstairs, and he's kind of thinking about this he's kidding with himself. But the idea crushed him, and me, who will be able to defend me? Supposing Fouquet does have my posthumous pamphlet printed, that will only be another source of shame. What? I'm received into a household, and as repayment for the hospitality I receive, the kindnesses with which I have been showered, I print a pamphlet about what has happened. I assault the honor of their women. A thousand times better to have been a dupe. So Xu Yan himself does not see himself as someone who has gone into a household and seduced women, but he doesn't. He has written letters because he's afraid he's going to be killed when he tries to seduce Matilde, so he's seducing her, to his friend Fouquet, and he wants Fouquet to remove all names, but that it's going to be published. So he himself has done some writing that has led to something that may indeed prove to be something that he doesn't want to happen. The act of writing in itself is a kind of an aggression, even more so than the pistol shot in some way, which still begs the question about why does he shoot Madame de Rênal. Well, The Red and the Black is, of course, based on the true story of Antoine Berthet, okay, that Stendhal had found it in the Gazette des Tribunaux, which is, it's a newspaper in France where trials are repeated and reported. And according to the biographer Jonathan Keats, it's also based on another case of Adrien Lafargue. But Berthet was the son of a blacksmith who trained in the seminary before entering into the service of a wealthy family. It's not clear exactly what happens, but he's dismissed. Perhaps there had been some indiscretion there. And then his employer gets him a job in another family, and there he does have a dalliance with the daughter of the family. He's getting a little too close to her, and so he gets angry with the first employer's wife, and he shoots her at mass, severely wounding her, and he ends up going to the scaffold like Julien. And for some critics, these are the bookends. Julien is Antoine Berthet, and he has to go to the scaffold. In the Lafargue case, there was a young cabinet maker who finds his mistress in bed with her former lover, and he goes in, shoots her, slits her throat, and he is given a relatively brief prison sentence. That's it. So the crimes passionnels are treated very differently depending, and I think of what Charles said about, oh, I was so glad to hear it was just a sort of domestic, an incident of domestic violence. And in fact, I'd like you to hold on to that notion. In her work, Crimes of Passion, Dramas of Private Life in 19th Century France, Joëlle Guillet suggests that the way that we read such acts today in terms of mental instability is very different than the way that they were read in the 19th century. And one element that we tend to forget is the perpetrator's sense of honor. The play Erdany was just mentioned. It was an important play in French literature in 1830. There was a big brouhaha over whether the romantics were going to prevail at that particular opening. And it's about honor. So honor is an important thing, whereas today we would say, well, you know, my students, when they read about René and he seems depressed, they say, well, why doesn't somebody just give him some Prozac? But anyway, and then we have to talk about the romantic code. Let's see. So I wanted to talk about some crimes of passion that I know about as a scholar of women's literature, simply to elucidate a little bit what the crime passionnel is like in this particular period, which runs from about 1830 to 1840. In 1838, a recently published French woman writer, somebody who had just published a book, was shot at point-blank range in the Rue du Bac on the left bank. Rumors circulated that it was the notorious Georges Sand, she with the cigar in the pants. But it was soon determined that the writer in question was Flora Tristan, the victim of her estranged husband, André Chazal. Interesting, Chazal, Sorel, Jeanrel, etc. The trial that followed was a sensational one. Tristan, called Flore Moscoso in the trial, I'll get to who she is, in the legal proceedings, had published an autobiographical account of her journey to Peru to seek out her father's family and paternal inheritance. She was half French, half Peruvian, and her father was a noble. Her mother was a French emigre who had left France during the revolution to escape the violence. She was not noble, she was a bourgeoise, But she was in Spain, they met, and they married. They got married in a church, but that wasn't good enough under French law at the time the French were in Spain. You had to register your marriage in a civil ceremony at the town hall, and they didn't do that. So she ended up being considered illegitimate, and hence the title of her autobiographical writing is Peregrinations of a Pariah. She's a pariah because she's, among other things, illegitimate, but she had other things that made her a pariah as well, and I'll get into that. In the preface, she critiqued the institution of marriage and women's forced enslavement under the Napoleonic Code, the fact that there was no divorce. She would later pen a petition to the deputies, to the Chamber of Deputies, to get divorce reinstated. Obviously it didn't work because it doesn't happen until 1884. But under the Napoleonic Code, not only was divorce not permitted, but a woman was seen as a minor under her father's or her husband's authority. So if there were some sort of a separation, the husband automatically would get custody of the children and all control of the funds, as we have heard, and so on. So she's protesting this. So she's a vehement voice against marriage, and we've seen in Madame de Rênal and Monsieur de Rênal why that might be. Flora had good reason in some ways. The situation does mirror George Sand and Casimir Dudevant, in that her husband was an alcoholic. He was a proprietor. He was a printmaker. And in fact, she had met him at the print shop. She was working for him, and she married her employer, and it seemed like she was, you know, rising in the world, being a pariah without a particular social status. But his business was going badly, and they fought all the time, threw dishes at each other. She would run back to her mother's house. And at one point, she accused him of incest with their daughter. And because she was a woman and because the daughter was a woman, they were both considered children. And the only other witness to the potential incest, it was very common in this period of time for artisans and workers to share a family bed. People only had one bed sometimes. There was some evidence given by the little girl's brother. But in any case, they found that there was not enough evidence because it was only children and people with the status of children, Flora, who were testifying. The little girl, by the way, turned out to be the mother of the artist Paul Gauguin, Aline Gauguin. So anyway, finally, after all of this, she's taken him to court, she's left him. Nothing provokes Chazal up until this point to do anything. But when she publishes Peregrinations of a Pariah and talks about her unhappy marriage, and she doesn't mention any of this business about incest or anything like that, just that the institution of marriage should be eliminated for people that are unhappy in it, that's when he shoots her. And it's because she has published about their private life. Again, it's a crime of honor. But Chazal's defense attorney, at the time, he was Jules Favre, he's important in 1848 in the Republican government. He was an important statesman, in fact, throughout the second half of the 19th century. He argued that Chazal had been pushed in the attempted murder of his wife because she had left the marital union and taken up with another person, which he hadn't, but he thought so. The defense then was based on the conventional contractual relationship of husband and wife in marriage. And I think actually this was a big mistake on the part of this lawyer, because what he did was he set up Flora to be the romantic heroine, the extraordinary person, the superior person in the romantic code, in the newspapers. And the Gazette des Tribunaux published this case as well. This is what he says about her, and you'll see that she comes off as being highly strong, very passionate, and very romantic. Mr. Jules Favre explained the facts in the following way. Mr. Chazal, a printmaker, is the husband of Flora Moscoso, whose ardent passions, exalted by the heat of the Castilian blood that runs in her veins. After Hernani, okay, he's Spanish too, okay? okay, made Mr. Chazal the most unhappy of men. Constant neglect of conjugal trust caused Mrs. Chazal to leave the marital home amidst 1,000 disorders in order to go live with other persons and to even spread her intrigues overseas. In Peru, wow. Returning to Paris, she lived there in the very home of the man she prefers to her husband. It's not true, actually. The latter, the husband, who, because of a weak character, put up with everything, believed one day that he had to go visit this domicile. But he was received with such scandal that he got out of there in order to never again make an effort to get near her. But then he finally shoots her. You know, he buys some pistols and he shoots her. But he does come off as the wronged husband, the conventional person. And she is the extraordinary person. And I think that this, in fact, is one of the reasons that he lost at trial. He was sentenced to 20 years at hard labor. And it's interesting that after her death, she became a labor organizer, which is also interesting. She in fact, is one of the very first people to call for the International Organization of Labor in her works a little bit after these. And Marx and Engels used her works to write their work. So she's an interesting character in and of her own right. But she, she's this heroic person who goes out to fight for the labor. She actually died. They could never get the bullet out of her body. And she was in weakened condition for the rest of her life, and she finally succumbs to typhoid while she's touring the country trying to get some kind of support for this workers' union that she wants to begin. But anyway, her husband, while he's in prison, decides that he's going to adopt the notion that he's the pariah, and appeal to the government for some kind of a reprieve. But it doesn't work. So I think he saw that his lawyer had done him a disservice. Again, this question of honor is really important in these crimes. And I think that that's a big part of what Julien is doing in The Red and the Black. And clearly, during his drawn-out imprisonment, Julien and Madame de Renal, they rediscover this wonderful passion in prison. And the time that they spend together is no longer compromised by Julien's worldly ambitions. They're beyond this world in some sense, and that's the romantic part, to the point where we can believe that when Julien is guillotined and Madame de Renal dies 3 days later, not of any injuries, but because she has to in this romantic code, she's a fictional character too, we can believe they're joined eternally. And Julien reflects upon this, and I'm not going to go into Stendhal's religious beliefs. I think it's just a part of that fictional code that we have to listen to. And finally, as an aside, I wanted to talk about one more crime of passion. Lest you think that only men were involved in crimes of passion, I'd like to tell you about another, where the subject is a woman, but you'll see that the message is very similar. It's a passion it's in defense of honor. And it's a real life story from French Letters, and it upends the gender roles that we see in Stendhal in some sense, and in the Tristan Chazal case. In 1840, the poet Louise Collet, and some of you may know the name Louise Collet. She's very infamous for having been the mistress of Gustave Flaubert for 9 years. And some people say that she was the model for Madame Bovary. I don't know about that, but she had a part in the writing of the novel, I'm sure. But anyway, she didn't know Flaubert at this particular point in time. She was maligned in the press by the editor Alphonse Carr, who had a particularly nasty column of a newspaper called Les Guêpes, the Wasps. It was very misogynist. She had just won the poetry prize of the Académie Française, which was really unheard of, a woman winning the poetry prize. But it was by blind submission. But the problem was that although the competition was by blind submission, she happened to be sleeping with Academy member Victor Cousin. He was her lover, okay? And he was almost certainly the father of her unborn child. So she's pregnant at the time. And he, Carr, and by the way, Carr is also attributed the quotation, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. So I'm echoing everybody here, I know. But anyway, Colet enjoined her husband, Hippolyte, to defend her honor, but he apparently was not too motivated. He was, And so Colet, okay, who was 9 months pregnant at the time, okay, she's described as looking like a Roman matron, a massive Roman matron. She took it upon herself to pay a visit to Carr. She armed herself with a kitchen knife rather than a pistol, and in her cumbersome physical condition only succeeded in landing a glancing blow on Carr's back. But he quickly disarmed her. And it must have been, he said that it was her fault because she was trying to look like a dramatic heroine, and she raised the knife up like this. If she had gone straight at him like that, it would have been over. And she would have gone to jail. But anyway, he wrote up the incident. And, you know, this is somebody who hated women writers, and blue stockings were what they were called in this particular period. And he admitted he was wrong and that he admired Colet. And this is a translation of what he said. In her desire to avenge an injury by herself, alone, in full daylight, there is indeed an energy and courage that borders on nobility. I acted in bad taste, and I beg all women's forgiveness. Was he sincere? I don't know. He kept the knife on display in his house with a little plaque offered to be by Louise Colet in the back. But I think it does, and Colet writes her own response, and she insists upon, you know, this is an honor crime. She was trying to defend the honor of her unborn child. So that's what I have to say about crimes of passion and letters. But apparently the profession of literature was extremely dangerous in the 19th century.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.